I'm Dan Gottlieb. Thanks for listening to Voices in the Family. You know, for most of us, there's nothing extraordinary about time spent shopping. You go to the store, you get online, you got a budget in mind, you pick out something you need, done, right? Simple. Well, for a chunk of this population, that's not really the case. An estimated 6% or more of Americans suffer from what's called compulsive buying disorder, and their script is quite different. They feel a need to buy, often things they don't need. There's a preoccupation with shopping that takes up most of their day. The impulse to buy is strong, can become overwhelming. It feels like it's something they must do, has to do. And when they're done, there's a moment of gratification, followed almost immediately by feelings of regret, shame, and dread. On today's show, we're going to be talking about compulsive buying disorder, what it is, who it affects, and how it ties in with other things like mood disorders, anxiety disorders, substance abuse, even eating disorders. We've got two guests today, April Lane Benson and Elias Abujadeh. April Benson is a psychologist. She specializes in treatment of compulsive buying disorder. She's the author of To Buy or Not to Buy, Why We Overshop and How to Stop. April, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me, Dan.
Elias Abujadeh is a Stanford University psychiatrist and author. His books include Virtually You, The Dangerous Powers of E-Personality, and Compulsive Acts, A Psychiatrist, Tales of Ritual and Obsession. Elias, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Dan, for having me, and good morning to April as well.
Good morning, Elias.
I'd like to invite our callers to join us also. We're at 888-477-9499. Are you worried about yourself or a loved one? Maybe you're buying too much. Maybe you continually overspend your budget and have difficulty reining it in. Give us a call. 888-477-9499. Let's start with the people who have this disorder. You know, in my research, the numbers have been all over the place. April, let's start with you.
Well, we have two recent prevalence studies, one done in 2006 that Elias knows quite a bit about because he was involved in it, that suggested that 5.8% of the U.S. population might be classified as compulsive buying disorder as having it. And what was most unusual and interesting about that study's results were that it was almost evenly distributed between the two genders. Up until that, it was really thought that almost 90% of compulsive buyers were women. The other recent study that came out in 2008 had three different samples. The most conservative sample suggested 8.9% of the population could be classified as having compulsive buying disorder.
These numbers are really astounding. They're way more than people who have schizophrenia and other psychotic disorders. And at those 8.9%, you're approaching numbers of percentage of people who have depression. Elias, tell us what it is and what it's not.
So it's very important to try to come up with a definition that captures compulsive shopping really as a disorder, and to separate it from the casual shopping that most of us engage in, and maybe more than we would like to. Compulsive shopping as a clinical entity is the recurrent, repetitive buying of unneeded or unwanted things in a way that leads to negative consequences down the road. These negative consequences can include financial consequences, problems such as increased debt, home foreclosure, bankruptcy, etc., decreased productivity at work, in part because of the distractions that come with the compulsive shopping, and of course, a negative impact on relationships within the family, with loved ones, etc. So this is what compulsive shopping disorder refers to, and as April pointed out, the most accurate prevalence data is somewhere around 6 to 9%, which is pretty high and seems to be increasing. Now, it is very interesting to ask why these rates are going up. There are two studies that were conducted in what used to be East Germany, and one conducted in 1991 and one conducted in 2001. And there was a big jump in the prevalence rate that was seen in what used to be East Germany. And one explanation that was given for that is the increased sort of consumerist lifestyle that was adopted after unification. So something about the culture is encouraging this behavior. Well, and I argue in my book that the internet is also playing a role.
Well, I mean, my goodness, you know, I don't know about either one of you, but look at Amazon Prime, you know? I mean, it's one click, it's no shipping charge, and it's easy to send back. I mean, it's impulse buying just waiting there. You just need to click one finger. But there's also the...
We call it the pain of paying. The pain of paying on the internet is so much less than when we use cash, when we write a check. So that accounts for a lot of compulsive buying because the consequences are so far down the road, and we just don't have the kind of pain that's associated with forking over our, you know, cold cash.
Well, there's also the larger picture. I mean, what did President Bush say after 9/11? And you know, to go shopping, and we also heard it throughout the recession from economists and both presidents that the way to help the economy is to go spend your money, and that's what will bail us out. So, you know, it's an overall culture. But Elias, I want to turn to you. A big complaint about mental health professionals is that we diagnose everything, and everything becomes a type of addiction here. So first, to address these skeptics.
Yes. Well, everything falls on a spectrum. Not all shoppers, not all excessive spenders have compulsive buying disorder. But for a certain percentage of the population, for those individuals for whom this behavior results in significant negative consequences, such as the ones I mentioned earlier, there is no doubt in my mind and in their minds as they sit in my office discussing their problem that this is an addiction. Just like a person can get addicted to a substance, they can get addicted to a behavior. And for these individuals, the way they see it is as a behavioral addiction, and it behooves us to take their problem seriously, to try to help them, and to try to understand the underpinnings of this condition. What is it that is causing them to exhibit this out-of-control spending, despite the obvious negative consequences to them?
You know, you talked about it being like an addiction, Elias. When I read the phases associated with compulsive buying, they're identical to substance abusers. The phases are the rush of anticipation, the preparing to use, then shopping and spending. Is there a high afterwards, a kind of euphoria that comes
well,
after?
There's certain, There's certainly a high that accompanies the behavior, a euphoria, if you will, that can go along with the behavior. But there's also what sets in afterwards, which is the guilt, the shame, and at some point also the withdrawal, missing the experience and wanting to engage in it again and again to the detriment of their well-being and their lives. So in that sense, there are parallels with substance abuse and substance dependence, and this is why when people were first starting to define compulsive buying disorder, they really looked at the criteria used for substance abuse and incorporated those in their clinical and their diagnostic definition of compulsive shopping disorder.
April, give us the inside story with compulsive shopping or buying. What's it like to be compulsive around this? And tell us how and when it develops. Like, walk us through the interior.
I think that compulsive buying disorder does exist along a continuum between something that's more impulsive and something that's more compulsive. So for the person for whom this behavior is more impulsive, there's a steady mounting tension that's relieved by the buying, and as Elias said, only temporarily. Mood studies that we have suggest, though, that the post-purchase mood is still a little bit better than the pre-purchase mood, which is what makes it so reinforcing. For the person who is more compulsive, it is more along the lines of compulsive hand washing, not something that they particularly want to do, but feel that they have to do. So that's part of what the interior experience is of the person who's got the problem. And in terms of what drives it, we do know that for most compulsive buyers, what they're trying to do is close the gap between who they are and who they would like to be or how they would like to be seen, which we call the self-discrepancy gap. And that is a first cousin of the aspiration gap, which is the distance between what we have and what we want.
It sounds almost, April, like you're describing a variation on the emperor's new clothes, so that we're buying clothing, we're buying externals to kind of hide or fill in what we don't have inside?
Exactly, Dan. I think you've put it exactly the way it is. It's an attempt to fill in for something that is perceived to be missing.
Well, go on.
You can never get enough of what you don't really need. And what somebody really needs is not that eighth pair of black boots. It may be more love and affection in their lives. It may be more a sense of belonging. It may be more self-esteem. It may be the esteem of other people they're looking for. Or it might be to self-actualize. And the shopping can be a misdirected, misguided approach to meeting that authentic need.
Do they know this?
I don't think they know it until they really stop and do some work on it.
You know, we're touching on a lot of issues here. Let me reintroduce you, and I want to come back and just tick off a few of the issues we're talking about. We're talking about compulsive buying here on Voices in the Family. My guests are Doctors April Lane Benson and Elias Aboujadeh. Our number is 888-477-9499. Again, that's 888-477-9499. Elias, you know, we are touching on, you know, when April talks about that emptiness inside, we could be talking about a depression, or the parallels to an eating disorder, because shopping is consuming. So we're talking about possible depression, anxiety disorder, eating disorder. You compared it to a substance abuse. And, you know, it's clearly OCD. April touched on that also. So what is it? What is it, Elias?
Well, we're still trying to understand exactly what motivates it, what's behind this this behavior. I think the first step, though, from a clinician perspective, is to rule out other conditions that might be driving the excessive buying. As you pointed out, a lot of individuals who come to us with this problem are depressed. So the question that we often ask ourselves is, are they shopping because they're depressed and they're using shopping as some form of quote-unquote retail therapy? And if that's the case, the accurate approach is to address the depression and treat the depression following, you know, the guidelines that we have for the treatment of depression. Or are they? Is the depression a consequence of the shopping behavior? Are they depressed because of all the debt they have incurred, all the negative impact to their relationships, etc.? And as a result of these consequences, they have fallen into a clinical depression. So it's really important to understand what else besides shopping is going on and what came first, in a sense, and target your treatment accordingly. Having said that, it is common for these conditions to occur simultaneously, if you will, not necessarily in a cause and effect manner. A big percentage of patients with compulsive buying have anxiety or depression as what we call comorbid conditions, you know, co-occurring conditions.
Well, and you see this with most of the times when you're treating substance abuse, you see co-occurring.
You certainly see it with substance abuse and with compulsive buying. When you look at all the studies that have been done, it's really the rule rather than the exception for there to be other conditions co-occurring with it. And while you know, we might not have very clear guidelines on treating compulsive buying, we do have clear guidelines on treating anxiety and depression, and we really should follow those in addressing those co-occurring conditions as we approach treatment for compulsive buying.
Yeah, I want to get more into treatment and what we can do. Let's take a short break and talk about what individuals and what families can do about this. We're talking about compulsive buying today and what it is, what it looks like, and what it feels like with Drs. April Lane Benson and Elias Aboujadeh. Benson's a psychologist. She specializes in compulsive buying disorder. She's the author of To Buy or Not to Buy, Why We Overshop and How to Stop. Elias Aboujadeh is a Stanford University psychiatrist, and his book on this topic is called Compulsive Acts, A Psychiatrist's Tales of Ritual and Obsession. Like I said, we're at 888-477-9499. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. It's right here on WHYY-FM.
One in three families is affected by problems caused by drugs or alcohol. The Family Training Program is a service for those concerned about their child, age 12 to 25, that may be using drugs or drinking. If eligible, you will be invited to sessions with a family specialist to help make positive changes in your life and in the relationship with your child. Held in Philadelphia by the Treatment Research Institute, a supporter of WHYY. More at 877-I-WORRY-2, 877-I-WORRY-2, or online at iamconcerned.org.
Devereaux is a proud supporter of WHYY. For more than 100 years, Devereaux has provided care to individuals with developmental disabilities and mental and behavioral health disorders. Devereaux's work also includes its full continuum of autism-specific programming for individuals of all ages, including residential services, community-based group homes, employment training, and support and educational programs. For more information on Devereaux's autism-specific services, devereaux.org.
Mm-hmm. We are back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We're talking about compulsive buying and when it becomes a disorder and what to do about it. We're with Drs. Elias Aboujadeh and April Lane Benson. Elias, in one of the articles you published, you used something called the compulsive buying scale. Tell us about that scale.
Yes, the compulsive buying scale is a 7-item questionnaire, if you will, that was developed to measure the feelings and the behaviors linked to compulsive buying disorder. It is one of the scales that has been statistically validated, meaning it has undergone some research scrutiny to help make sure that it is actually measuring what it says it is measuring. And for that reason, it's one of the preferred scales used to try to measure the prevalence of compulsive buying.
What kind of questions do you ask?
So, you know, the questions have to do with the feelings around compulsive buying, what it is that may be motivating it. Is it a negative mood? Is it a positive mood? It tries to track the feelings, again, that precede but also accompany and follow the behavior, as well as the context that the activity is happening within.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to the phones. We've got David on the line. David, hi, you're on the air.
Yes, I'm an economist, and many economists I know assume that markets give us what we want. Now, it will give us what we will buy. Once it's out there. In other words, if something impulsive or compulsive is there, that's what market forces do. But it doesn't respond to how we feel about what we do. In other words, it doesn't fulfill our desires about our desires. Now, I've written a book
David, what do you mean it doesn't fulfill our desires about our desires?
Well, again, I'm an economist, and I model this. I've done a book. I'm not going to mention this isn't a promotional station, and it shouldn't be. But it doesn't care about how we feel about what we do. In other words, the drugs will be out there. The things that will make people buy compulsively are there. Those are market orders. Those are people listening to the market, not to their deeper self.
Right. Right. So, you know, you said, and I want to hear my guest's reaction to that, but, you know, one of the things David said to us, and thanks for your call, it's really interesting to hear from an economist on this issue, but, you know, I often feel in April, I'd like to hear your thoughts, that the markets don't give us what we want. Often the markets tell us what we want.
Dan, I think you're absolutely right. And one of the important skills that somebody who has this problem needs to develop is some kind of media literacy. For example, is it really likely that if we use this perfume that we are going to have hordes of men showering us with Casablanca lilies like we see in the ad? You know, we've got to subject some of what we see to a reality test.
And how is that done?
Well, I think by asking questions. What is the message of this ad? What is the feeling that it's evoking? Anxiety and envy are two of the big ones. Oh, I want to be like that person in the ad. It's, you know, if I buy this, I will be like them. Or if I don't buy this, look what could happen to me.
I wanted to have 6-pack abs, but all that money I spent, I've got a 1-pack ab, actually. So.
What,
and I didn't get my money back. Go on.
One other thing about this is, as opposed to almost any other addiction, with perhaps the exception of workaholism, compulsive buying is the smiled upon addiction because consumption fuels our economy. What other problem do we have? Tongue-in-cheek disease names like appendicitis, luxury fever, affluenza. You know, we don't joke about drug addiction, alcoholism.
Let's bring in another caller. We've got Dennis on the line. Hi, Dennis.
Hi there. I missed the first 10 or so minutes of your program, so I hope you didn't cover this, but I wanted to see what you all thought about the connection between hoarding and compulsive and impulsive buying, because I've got a brother that is a definitely compulsive and impulsive buyer, and he also has a problem with hoarding. He orders things on the internet, and when those things that he buys come into the house, he takes the cardboard boxes that they come in and piles them up in his basement. Still, he has a chance to recycle them. Well, they get recycled when I go to visit him twice a year from across the state. So I wonder if you could talk about the hoarding connection there.
That's really interesting. Elias, do you want to take that?
Certainly. So hoarding is more similar to obsessive-compulsive disorder. In someone who has a hoarding problem, they have great difficulty getting rid of unnecessary items because the fear is, what if I might need it someday? Whereas with compulsive buyers, oftentimes they will happily, you know, donate these purchases or return them to the store or just forget about them and keep them in their original packaging and never open them again. So it's a different kind of mechanism, if you will, and a different set of feelings that accompany the behavior. Now, some of the treatment interventions can be similar, but in terms of how they present, they are somewhat different entities, and it's important to figure out whether you're working with somebody who's more of a compulsive buyer or a hoarder under the OCD sort of category.
We're talking about, thanks for your call, Dennis. We're talking about compulsive buying as a variant on OCD, on substance abuse, a byproduct of depression, or maybe how it results in depression. Our number is 888-477-9499. Again, that's 888-477-9499. April.
Dan, I was just going to add something about hoarding to Dennis's, to Elias's answer to Dennis. And that is that sometimes we don't know what we're dealing with because hoarding tends to increase across the life cycle. So one-third of compulsive buyers tend to develop into hoarders, but we may not know that early on.
I want to get to gender issues here, April. I got to be honest. I was surprised when you said it was almost 50-50, and we might have to get to a definition here, because, you know, I talk to a lot of people, friends, colleagues, between shows about what's coming up next. And when I said to my male friends or colleagues, you know, we're doing a show on compulsive buying, you know, their eyes would glaze over and they'd say, oh, interesting. And when I spoke to a couple of women, close friends, and they both got defensive. And, you know, others said they were really looking forward to hearing about it. So, you know, in my small sample of five people, you know, there was clear gender breakdown there.
There are differences in the way the disorder looks in men and women. I think there are also differences in the degree to which someone might admit this. women are much more likely to report for research studies, to label themselves to begin with. I think men tend to adopt a work frame to the shopping process, women a leisure frame. Women will go out and gather and gather. And, for example, in Rob Becker's Defending the Caveman, he says, a man goes out and sees a shirt, he shoots the shirt, and he brings it home. I do think that that is one variant with the rise of internet shopping. I think that is one of the reasons we're seeing more and more male compulsive buyers. There was a PayPal study in 2011 in England which suggested that men are coming to the internet at a faster rate than women. They are buying more on the internet than women, and even in such traditionally female categories as health and beauty products. Men, though, often are more the image spenders, buying big-ticket items, and also are sometimes called collectors, which gives it a highbrow, somewhat refined cast.
That's really interesting. So when I am with a woman and she's shopping for a top, I just feel my life draining away. But, you know, I'm looking for, you know, a new bank of windows for my kitchen, and, you know, I'm all over the place shopping for that. So I and you know what? She says, "Oh, that's interesting," and she's not telling the truth. So, you know, we're both doing the same thing. But it just looks different and feels different. Let's go back to the phones. We've got Debbie on the line. Hey, Debbie.
Hello.
Hi, Debbie.
Hello.
Yes.
I'm here.
Yes, so are we.
Hi, thank you so much for taking my call. I'm calling because I can definitely relate to this topic. I have an anxiety disorder that I've, for many, many years, been taking medication and feel that I live a very happy life. But I realize that I shop impulsively because something else in my life is missing. I'm not always sure what it is. Sometimes I'll do it when I'm really happy, and I'll do it when I'm really upset. I feel that I'm not in debt. I don't put my family in debt. However, I certainly could. We could have more if I and contribute more and save more if I didn't shop, but always feel justified when I go shopping. Sometimes I'll go to the grocery store and say, well, we need food, so I'll just go and buy things that are on sale, or go clothes shopping and that I needed it, or get something for my daughter because she needed it, or and it's at that time feeling good. And then, of course, like everybody's been talking about, when it's over, I don't feel good because I know I really didn't need to do that. Over the years, I've found a strategy that has worked for me. Sometimes I'll go when I really, really need to go, and I'll shop, whether it's groceries or clothes, and I'll put a lot of things that I really want in my basket, and then I'll leave. I'll leave it in the middle of the store, and I walk out. And feel like, good, phew, I did that, and I got a little bit out of my system, but I didn't spend any money, and I'm okay, and I can go on with my day. So
that's really interesting. I just want to flag one thing that that interested me right in the beginning of your conversation. When you described the trigger, and you said you feel there's something missing in your life at that moment, and you don't know what it is. Can I want to suggest something to you?
Sure.
That maybe there is nothing missing, but it's that feeling that you're labeling something's missing. It's a feeling inside, a visceral feeling in your body that you experience as distressing or intolerable.
Mm-hmm.
It's just an emotion. It's a bodily sensation. If you take that label away, there's the potential to learn something about your experience before you go shopping.
Okay.
To learn something about you. But let's, Elias, how about if you weigh in on this?
I would agree with the experience that the caller is sharing with us. It resonates in terms of the patients that I work with. Yes, a negative mood sometimes will trigger compulsive buying, but also a happy mood. You know, we buy to celebrate, just like we buy when we're depressed in order to feel better. You know, so it could be any number of emotional triggers, but it could be also this sensation of void, of emptiness, or it could be that there's really nothing, you know, significantly wrong, if you will, on a psychological level, but that these very sophisticated marketing tools that are being used and that are targeting them, that are targeting us in very sort of individualized, personalized ways now, it's really hard to resist all this. And it's easy for us to become victims and become prey to all this very sophisticated advertising that we're being constantly bombarded with.
April, I'd like to hear your thoughts for Debbie.
I think that it's really important to notice if there is what's going on in your body. In fact, one of the first interventions I ask people to do is to ask themselves the question, how does your body know you want to shop? Because sometimes the body is the first responder. And if you can notice a rapid heartbeat, your palms are sweaty, you feel a knot in your stomach, that can tip you off to something else. You can work with that physiological sensation, and it will create a pause between the impulse and the action of shopping. So I think that understanding and getting in touch with your bodily self is really important.
I couldn't agree more. Debbie, or do we still have you?
I'm still here, and I agree, and,
all right,
and it's funny.
One last question before we have to go to our break. How's your relationship with Debbie?
It's touch and go.
Yeah.
You know, sometimes it's really good, and other times it's questionable as to... I feel like, am I really able to be who I feel like I want to be versus who I think I should be?
Yeah.
In the role that I am as a wife and a mother.
Oh, all those shoulds, they're horrible, aren't they?
Yes.
Yeah, and you know what? Anybody who loved you would put their arm around you and say, you know, you are who you are, and that's just... fine. Just rest in that. And
Thank you.
My hope is that you can look in the mirror and do that for yourself.
Thank you. I'm working on it.
Take good care. Don't work too hard. Just rest.
Okay.
All right.
Thank you so much, and thank you for all you do.
Sure. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
We're talking about compulsive buying disorder with Drs. April Lane Benson and Elias Boujade. Benson's a psychologist specializing in this. She's an author of several books. Boujade is a psychiatrist at Stanford. He's written several books on this topic. And our number is 888-477-9499. By the way, all of their books will be on our webpage. Again, 888-477-9499. When we come back, I want to talk about treatment, what are individuals to do, and what are families to do when they see a daughter, a wife, a mother, or a father engaged in compulsive buying. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. It's right here on WHYY-FM.
Do you feel the need to check and recheck constantly? Are you a prisoner of certain rituals and compulsions? Keystone Clinical Studies in Norristown is conducting a research study of an investigational medication for treating obsessive compulsive disorder, or OCD. If you're between 18 and 65 and have been diagnosed with OCD, you may be eligible to participate. 610-277-8073, 610-277-8073, or KeystoneClinicalStudies.com. Keystone Clinical Studies supports WHYY.
Devereaux is a proud supporter of WHYY. For more than 100 years, Devereaux has provided care to individuals with developmental disabilities and mental and behavioral health disorders. Devereaux's work also includes its full continuum of autism-specific programming for individuals of all ages, including residential services, community-based group homes, employment training, and support and educational programs. For more information on Devereaux's autism-specific services, devereaux.org.
We are back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We're talking about compulsive buying disorder with April Lane Benson, psychologist and psychiatrist Elias Aboujadeh. Let's take another phone call. Here we've got John on the line. Hi, John.
Oh, hi, how are you?
Hi, good.
I noticed when I would shop impulsively that I seemed to kind of notice that it was a social interaction I was looking for, that I would develop a relationship with the stores I would go to, the people I shopped from, and it was actually, it felt like I was accomplishing something, like I was in control of the transaction. People were more than happy to see me. And in times of loneliness and stuff, I would find myself going out to shop because there were people who were waiting eagerly to see me, I guess. Yeah. So I just wondered
you said,
your thoughts on that.
You said waiting eagerly to see you, I guess.
Yeah, well, I mean, if you're a paid store employee, you're supposed to be happy to greet customers and stuff, even though you might not care too much for them, you know?
What's that like for you, John? What's that interaction?
I guess that could add to the depression after I go back home again, because you realize that this is not exactly a caring friendship that you would imagine it might be, you know?
Yeah. So I can read Elias's mind now and say, well, now we have to think about treating John for depression, and this is also something that's very treatable. But I would also wonder if we, you know, if medication is the treatment of choice for loneliness.
Well, John lists loneliness and social isolation as a clear trigger in his case. So if I were working with John, I would try to target that and try to increase his social support network in a way that that might make him rely less on going to the mall to feel this sort of human connection and this social connection. You know, beyond that, for treating compulsive buying disorder can benefit from any number of psychopharmacological but also psychotherapy interventions. And I don't know whether you wanted to cover those as part of the answer to this question or...
Yeah, go on.
So the study...
Now, these might not be appropriate for John, but
we're
generalizing.
Not treating any individual caller or individual listener here, but just in general, looking at the studies that have been conducted, the family of medications called the SSRIs that people may have familiarity with have been studied now in 4 randomized controlled trials. The results, unfortunately, have been pretty inconsistent and all over the map, so it's hard to make a single recommendation for this particular class. It doesn't mean that any individual patient might not respond to them, but it has to be approached, obviously, on a case-by-case basis. But these are reasonable options that sometimes might be used to target compulsive buying disorder. On the psychotherapy front, the form of therapy that has received the most attention is cognitive behavioral therapy. The studies that have been published have been mostly group therapy studies, and the idea there is to target the cognitions that a person has around shopping. For instance, shopping as a way to improve one's social status, shopping as a way to empower oneself. Try to target those assumptions that are faulty and that the patient makes as a way to justify the shopping behavior. And then also focus on the behavioral side, not just the cognitive side, but also the behavioral side, with individualized interventions such as limiting the amount of money that the person might take with them when they go shopping, have a person accompany them, keep a log of their shopping behavior and look at the context that the shopping tends to happen in and try to transform that context.
There's a lot of options, but I want to come all the way back now to John and talk to you, April, that here's a guy, diagnosis aside, here's a guy that comes to you because he's really suffering from loneliness. Now what?
We would start to look at what this overshopping, what function is it serving in John's life? And he's told us that one of the functions is that it serves to make him feel more connected to other people, maybe even more a sense of belonging. We'd look at how it all came to be. We'd look at his ambivalence about changing. We'd look at what other ways there are to meet this need for more social interaction. We'd look at how to strengthen his underlying psychological muscles, the ones that make it difficult for him to tolerate the distress of loneliness. We'd look at how to perhaps increase John's interpersonal effectiveness. Are there ways that, why is he lonely? Why is it that in the controlled environment of the store, where the salesperson is happy to see you, and in the best establishments really do form a relationship with individual customers, why is it that John doesn't have those kind of relationships with trusted others? Why does he, quote unquote, have to buy them?
Yeah, so all these things need to be examined. And boy, John, if you're still there, what I want for you is to be able to make some of these relationships, to reach out, and maybe not peers. I send an awful lot of my patients out to volunteer and to help others and do what they can to make the world a better place. And when you volunteer and you're shoulder to shoulder with other volunteers, you meet some pretty cool people in your life. You meet some kindred spirits, and that can change lots of things in your life. So I wish you the best. I really appreciate your call and all of it that it brought up. April, I want to talk to you about what a family does when someone in the family is buying compulsively. Let's say it's in a marriage. What happens in a marriage?
Well, I think there's a lot of friction. The non-buying spouse often feels pretty impotent and angry and frustrated, hopeless, helpless to do anything about it, doesn't know what to do.
What can they do? Should they do?
The first thing is to really tell the overshopping spouse what they see and what impact it's having, in as non-emotional a way as possible. Also, I think it's very important not to enable the overshopper by being part of the problem in terms of looking the other way periodically about the overshopping, intermittently taking a very hard line, and then at other times, saying, fine, it's okay.
I think one's got to be consistent. I think there are resources available. Unfortunately, we don't have the kind of resources yet for compulsive buying disorder that we have for many other things. But a place like Al-Anon can be helpful. And on my website, there are tips for friends and family. In extreme cases, intervention is possible.
And when you say extreme cases, I wonder if this can go on to illegal behaviors at its extremes.
Very much. I worked with the first shopaholic case defense case in the nation, where I've worked with a number of people who have stolen from family businesses, embezzled from their employers. Definitely. Shoplifting is a related issue, so there it definitely borders and often crosses the line to illegality.
And does restricting help?
I think restricting in and of itself isn't enough. It can be one component of a much larger program. For example, when I work with people and they formulate a weekly goal, one of the first goals that many people come up with is restricting the either amount of time they spend surfing on the internet, or they unsubscribe from certain shopping websites. But that in and of itself is not enough. It's got to be bolstered by strategies, skills, and tools to, as I say, help with developing and strengthening the underlying psychological muscles that make people much less prone to taking over shopping and then through symptom substitution turning it into overeating.
Which we know happens all too often. Well, unfortunately, we're out of time. I want to thank you both so much for joining us. I think it's been an enlightening show. My guests have been psychologist April Benson, psychiatrist Elias Aboujadeh. Next week, we're going to be talking about young adult drinking, when it's a problem, or is it always a problem? You can comment on today's show or listen to Archive Edition on our website. That's whyy.org/voices. You can follow us at Twitter. We're Voices in the Fam, and I am at drdangottlieb.com. Well, the engineer for today's show has been Al Banks. Elizabeth Perez-Loon is our executive producer of audio content. Anna DiStefano is our summer intern. Emily Haas is our production assistant. Mike and Scott's our executive producer. Jennifer Lynn is our producer. Me? I'm Dan. Enjoy your week, my friends.